From APR, American Public Radio.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. One of the most important and original voices in 20th century literature is that of David Herbert Lawrence. D.H. Lawrence lived from 1885 to 1930, and in that time produced a series of novels, poems, and essays that are stirring examinations of the human condition. Yet for all that, the degree to which the life of this vital author influenced and structured his mind and his art remains a fertile and largely unexplored territory. My guest today is Mark Kincaid Weeks, Professor Emeritus of English Literature at the University of Kent at Canterbury. Mark, welcome to Dialogue.
Nice to be here.
Mark, you are at work on a biography of D.H. Lawrence, which I think is tremendously exciting in itself, and it has a special focus on the ways in which the life of this artist shaped his mind and his creativity. And I think that suggests kind of a natural beginning for our conversation, Mark, in terms of his origins. Now, I know that he was born in the mining district in a town called Eastwood, I believe, and that his father was a miner, his mother was a former teacher. But what should we make of this? I mean, how important were these origins and these parents to what he eventually did?
Well, I think there are some ways in which he never left his origins at all. He thought of that particular extraordinary area of the Nottinghamshire-Derbyshire border, which is both a coal mining area and an area of unique natural beauty in the Midlands of Britain. He thought of that as always the country of his heart, to which he returned again and again in his writing. And of course, in the sense that we are all the product of our own upbringing, both creatively and as trauma, in that way too, his origins never left him. But he did make a clean break in many ways with his working class background. His mother, incidentally, although she had been a pupil teacher, was not the woman who had married beneath her that she made her children believe. In fact, her father was what we'd call a fitter and turner now, I think a mechanic engineer, who had an industrial accident which plunged the family into very reduced circumstances. Lawrence grew up in this household in which his mother had aspirations towards refinement and self-improvement that her husband didn't share. It was a household of great tension, which perhaps started off his abiding belief that conflict was both a terribly destructive and a creative, potentially creative thing.
You know, I have a suspicion, Mark, as one personally who has much admired the writings of D.H. Lawrence, that he's a writer that's proven to be rather elusive for facile characterization, although I think there are many who've attempted that. And often one gets the sense that when people try to describe Lawrence, even people who admire him, they tend to give us a caricature of the man rather than what he was really about. I mean, was he the author of The Natural Man? Was he a prophet of sexual liberation? Was he a mystic? Was he all of these things? Before we turn to a close examination of his ideas, I'd love to get your sort of ready description of who you feel D.H. Lawrence was as a writer and man.
I think I'd almost turn that on its head, George, really, and say that for me, he is a man of great complexity who acted out parts of himself in different and conflicting ways, believing as he did that this was in fact the source of creativity. So that always when people start off sentences beginning with D.H. Lawrence, I feel I want to say, which Lawrence are you talking about? And that is a matter chronologically, because he would have said with Whitman, I contradict myself very well, I contain multitudes. So I think one needs in the first place to talk about Lawrence chronologically, because he shifted and changed it as he thought all living creatures did. He thought, in fact, that stasis was a sure sign of death, and that change was a great, and flux was a great principle of life. So he's changeable in that fashion. And also, I think, although he's very many-sided, his many-sidedness was, again, a response to what he thought of as the many-sidedness of life. That to be consistent was probably to be leaving something out. And so what you did was, as it were, to live actively that which you were now, and to live equally actively that which you would be tomorrow, with no particular worry about whether those two were consistent.
This is a man who's engaged with life, Mark. It
always,
sounds.
Always.
Yeah.
For good or ill, in the sense that certain things that were happening in the world had a much greater effect on him than on certain other writers who had the ability to lock themselves away, as it were, and live in an imagined world of their own creating. He's a most illuminating contrast with Joyce in that respect.
Give us an example of that, Mark, because you're bringing us close to what your biography is all about now, the effect of the world on Lawrence.
Well, I would think the biggest example would be the First World War, which upset him more, I think, than it is possible easily to say in a sentence or two. He violently opposed it, not because he was a pacifist, which he was not, thinking that conflict and indeed violence were important parts of life. It wasn't that he was a pacifist, but that he thought this war was absolutely wrong and the product of destructive impulses in the societies and the people of Europe, which explained why young people should so extraordinarily and with such enthusiasm throw themselves into this in 1914. It was a period in which he felt himself more and more isolated, and indeed impoverished by isolation, so that he began a career of being, as it were, an alien and an anti-figure. He thought that Europe had gone destructively mad, and this made him try and penetrate deeper and deeper into what it was in human beings that created a phenomenon such as this, the most awful war that Europe had ever seen. And this led him into some dark places within the psyche. He was never content with socio-economic explanations of things. He thought the ultimate explanations of things had to lie within the human beings.
That's very helpful. You know, another idea, Mark, and here I think we move directly into the period of 1912 to 22, which is the precise focus of your scholarship now on Lawrence. It seems to me that the notion of industrial progress in that part of our century was much current and much ballyhooed. That almost also must have gone against the grain of Lawrence, I would suspect, or at least given him some grist for the mill.
That is true. And again, I think one would come back to the World War, which he saw as a war between industrialized nations and that most terrible thing, a war of machinery, when men had, in fact, subjected themselves to and were being slaughtered in enormous numbers by machines of their creating. He wasn't anti-machines. He thought of the Industrial Revolution as, and shows this in The Rainbow, as having opened up whole new horizons for people like himself. And he thought of machines as very useful adjuncts to life and of making material well-being. Of course, people had to have enough to eat, enough to wear, houses to live in, the goods that they required for the necessities of life. And then he said the important thing was to live,
right,
not to be caught up in the mechanistic vicious circles of industrial living.
The machine is an adjunct, not a dominant part.
Absolutely. And insofar as he thought British society and later American society had allowed itself to be dominated by industrialism, He again was a reactionary voice in that respect.
Mark, I can think of no better person to ask this question, because I suspect, and I suspect you'd agree with me, if we were to walk out and ask 10 or even 100 people about D.H. Lawrence right now, they would say, oh yes, he's the marvelous man who wrote so much about sexual liberation and the erotic. Let's address that point right now, because we are talking about things that were essential to Lawrence. Now, in what sense is he the man who wrote about sex and eroticism? In what sense is he not?
Well, I'd go further than that. I think if you picked people out off the street and asked them your question, they would probably say, oh, didn't he write Lady Chatterley's Lover?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it would be as straightforward as that.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is yes, and not entirely fortunately yes. He would have regarded himself, as he is regarded, as a man wishing to bring about a revolution in people's attitudes to sexuality. One of the two greatest of his works was Condemned for Obscenity, that's the Rainbow, by the Bow Street magistrate, and ordered to be destroyed, and wasn't available in England again for another 11 years. The other of his two greatest works, Woman in Love, couldn't find a publisher for 5 years at all, and eventually only came out in America in a private edition, first of all. And the primary reason, though not the only reason for this, was his insistence in writing with an explicitness and openness about human sexuality and sexual relationship that was regarded as offensive by his time. So there is a sense in which he helped to bring about, not alone, but with other people, the very remarkable change in our whole attitude towards sexuality and sexual relationship that makes the Bow Street magistrate's verdict on the Rainbow simply incomprehensible now. So, yes, he placed sexual relationship at the very heart of human creativity and the being oneself to the full. He didn't think you could be yourself to the full by yourself. Indeed, he regarded self-enclosure as one of the most appalling features of being human, the danger of self-explosion. So the first thing about sexual relationship was that it broke you open, as it were. It broke you out of yourself and forced you into the most intimate and disturbing contact with the other. So that sexual relationship he thought of as a kind of dying to one's earlier self and of being born into a wholly new kind of life. But I choose that language to make what seems to me a very important point, and that is that at the cost of a certain exaggeration, I think I would want to say that his attitude to sex was a curiously religious one.
Yes, I think that's quite right.
He wasn't interested in exploring sex as a source of pleasure or fun or self-fulfillment in the form of egoism or domination or anything like that. He did explore those features of sexual relationship, but he seriously thought of sex in a non-religious age, in which he described himself as a passionately religious man, as a way of exploring how human beings needed the other,
yes,
to change themselves. But in that very necessity for conflict and change had always to go on to new phases. So the sexual relationship for him was never complete. He'll use words like fulfillment or consummation. But when you look at the work, fulfillment never means something reached, a plateau on which, as it were, you can then sit. Fulfillment means the filling oneself so full of life that one is able to go on to what comes next, as it were, the next challenge. And he saw sexual relationship as the central human challenge for most people.
There's so much to talk to you about, Mark. I would want us to look in close detail at the novel, one of his two greatest novels, and Women in Love, in just a moment. Before we do that, though, let me just say that this is Dialogue. I'm George Liston, C.A., and my guest today is Mark Kincaid Weeks, currently a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center. He's at work on a biography of the author D.H. Lawrence. Mark Kincaid Weeks was educated at the University of Cape Town and at Oxford. His publications are many and include the books William Golding, A Critical Study, and Samuel Richardson, Dramatic Novelist. Well, Mark, the time has come now for us to look at this magnificent novel, and I must say that I consider it one of the finest I've ever read. And many say, and I agree with this also, that it's one of the greatest novels of this century, Women in Love. Now, we could profitably spend a great deal, many hours indeed, just talking about this book, but just to give us a capsule of an introduction into it, I think it's fair to say that on one level, it's the story of two couples in sort of a passionate, dramatic, and ultimately tragic circumstance. On another level, it's an exposition of ideas, and very powerfully so. So I guess to bring us quickly into it, the question might be, what statement is Lawrence making in this novel, Women in Love, and how central is that statement to his complete message?
I'm not sure that I'd think of it as a statement, George, though I know what you mean by that. I think I might try and use a word like exploration. The novel starts with two sisters talking about their hopes and apprehensions for the future, and talking more specifically about whether they ever want to get married and have children. And then each of them meets their man. And as you say, the novel takes its shape, Women in Love, and of course Men in Love, as an exploration of the comparison and contrast of these two couples in their relation towards one another, and therefore their relation towards the world they live in. But as it goes on, the thing that is most disturbing and exploratory about it is the way that Lawrence insists on delving below the surface of the social life we live with one another to, as it were, detonate moments of self-revelation. He very often will use some kind of catalyst. He'll isolate his characters in small groups or pairs and then have something which will bring out a self that they didn't know existed within them. And the most disturbing thing about the novel is that that self has an enormous capacity for violence. So the next thing I'd say about Women in Love is that although its time is left indeterminate, it was in fact written in perhaps the most terrible year that the world had ever known, 1916, the year of the battles of Verdun and of the Somme. And I would myself want to describe it quite seriously as a war novel, in the sense that it does seem to be asking about violence, the violence in everybody. High-born aristocratic ladies who suddenly spurt out in acts of physical violence, young girls who suddenly strike their men across the face and then say, why are you behaving in this absurd and impossible fashion? It is a novel that one could say in one sense is a violent and excessive novel. In another sense, is a novel attempting to diagnose the nature of violence and to ask whether violence is purely destructive or whether it has a creative element within it as well, which is a very disturbing thought to us. Right. I think this is another of the things about Lawrence. He does detonate problems of gender, of sexual relationship, and of domestic violence, if one may put it that way, that are still very much with us.
Yes, indeed.
And he can still produce a disturbing sense of questions that we would prefer to ignore.
Yes.
About ourselves in reading. So Women in Love, I think it is one of the greatest novels of the century. And I think it is that because of the courage of its explorations of the depth within its people that they don't want to recognize, but have to recognize and come to terms with if they are ever to create a loving relationship in the sense in which the novel finally defines it. So the sort of statement it makes is a question at the end. I think most of his greatest work ends with a question rather than a conclusion. And the question is, which way are we going to go? Are we going to go the way of the one couple who seem to be, by the end of the novel, travelling a path that could lead, though it hasn't led yet, to a fruitful and lasting relationship, or the path taken by the other couple, which ends in a tragedy that I won't explain for people who haven't read it, has a terrible and tragic ending. And the novel appears to be trying to diagnose the nature of these two contrasting paths of being men and women in love.
I hope you don't take this as idle flattery, but that is a magnificent exposition of the novel. I deeply appreciate that answer. You, among a number of things that you did in the course of it for me, to put it in the context of the First World War, although I knew it was written in 1916, I simply hadn't made what is obviously an essential connection. I want to ask you a question about the characterization in that novel. You mentioned at one point that the high-born lady who commits the act of violence, I think it's a paperweight she brings down on one character's head, and some argue that she was drawn on Lady Ottoline Morel at the time. And others, in fact, many suggest that Rupert Birkin, one of the key figures of this novel, one of the men in one of these two couples, is himself Laurentian, is himself Lawrence. Is this something that meets your...
Yes and no, and sorry if that seems evasive, but I'll try and say quickly why both things are true. He was quite ruthless about using real people and real places for fictive purposes. So the fiction starts off, as you so rightly say, from himself on the one hand and from people he knew on the other. But having said that, one then wants to drop it rapidly. In the first version of the novel, in the first manuscript we have, Birkin is very much a kind of D.H. Lawrence figure who says things that D.H. Lawrence wrote elsewhere and does things that Lawrence had done and voices, as it were, part of Lawrence's philosophy of life. But Birkin is quite clearly seen in the novel as a sick man and in some ways as a deathly man. A man who is struggling to escape from his own morbidity. And marvelously, the Ursula of the novel, who bears an equally strong resemblance to Frieda initially, to Lawrence's wife, is used as the novel develops and grows and begins to shed its sickness, as Lawrence thought one did in books. Ursula is used to attack Birkin, to criticize him for being a prig and a preacher, a man who wants people to be deathly and fleur de mal and so on. And in that sort of dramatic relationship, D.H. Lawrence, the writer, is clearly not at all to be confined within the views and the attitudes of Birkin, the character. And I would say the same thing would be true of all the characters in the novel. They may have their origins, as it were, in real life. But the power of the imagination is always to transpose, to select, to heighten, to use for novelistic purposes in the whole system of contrasts and comparisons that the novel actually is. So that eventually when people turned round and said, I am going to sue you because I am Halliday or I am Hermione, there was part of Lawrence that was disingenuous and said, it's not true, you're not. But another part, I think, was genuinely puzzled about why people couldn't see that he was not producing portraits of living people, but fictional characters. But it's a difficult distinction to draw, and much easier now when we're not personally involved.
Yes, I would think so. That's great. Mark, to conclude a conversation that I actually don't want to conclude ever, let me ask you this. We've spent our time talking about a man who wrote magnificently during the first third of this century. And here we are sitting in the last decade of it. And so for the benefit of people who haven't had the experience of reading Lawrence or wonder why we're making so much of him, what would you say to them? I mean, how would you answer the question, why should we bother reading this man now? Life's different. We're different. Why should we read him?
Oh, I'll try and give a scatter of reasons. First of all, the simple and the really important one is that although he's a little bit like the girl in The Curl as a writer, with The Curl rather, that when he is good, he is very, very good. He can be horrid, he can overwrite, and he can be shrill and preachy. in a marvelous parody of his own worst features in Woman in Love, in fact, when somebody reads one of Birkin's letters, and a very fruity and extraordinary and funny moment it is. But he is, I think, still manifestly the major British writer of the 20th century. I exclude Joyce for the moment as an Irishman and being different, but as far as British writers are concerned, I think he is still the finest and the most varied of them. He wrote poems, plays, novels, stories, books about psychology, a history book for school children, art criticism. He was the most astonishingly varied and brilliant writer. So the first thing is just... and a wonderful writer of letters, incidentally. So the first reason I would give about why read him, just because you will enjoy it and there's nobody quite like him. But secondly, I'm interested in him, I think, predominantly as an exploratory writer, as the kind of writer who continually reached out beyond what was the kind of conscious understanding of himself and of his time, continually extending the bounds, as it were, that fiction could handle, trying imaginatively to exceed what was then knowable and writable about, to lay hold of things which then the understanding, as it were, had to stretch itself to grasp finally. And I think in being exploratory about himself and about other people in that sort of way, wanting to get deeper than fiction had ever gone before, he did pull fiction onto a whole new dimension of awareness. So I think he's a major revolutionary writer. And he was a remarkably brave writer and brave man in the ruthlessness and power of his self-scrutiny about gender, about sexuality, about homosexuality and lesbianism, about violence, which we've talked about social tension. He still has the power to disturb because he refused to compromise with the mores of his age, which made him an alienated and isolated figure. We've taken generations to catch up with him, in fact. So an exploratory writer and a very brave one, an adventurous one. His pluck in Westminster Abbey simply reads Thought Adventurer.
Oh.
And I think that's very nice. I like that. If one had to have a single phrase, that will do as well as any. And I think that makes him an extraordinary figure too.
Well, I appreciate that very much, Mark, as I've appreciated the entire conversation. You make me aware of the fact that not only is he an important writer for our time, he probably is an essential writer for us to know in our time. And
I think we'd be a lot poorer without him.
I agree with you. Thank you so much, Mark Kincaid Weeks.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Mark Kincaid Weeks, Professor Emeritus of English Literature at the University of Kent at Canterbury. I am George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier. Our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by APR, American Public Radio, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.
From APR, American Public Radio.